creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
On this episode of Culture Click, we bring you how teaching at a tribal college changed my life, or at least my teaching, with Winona State University Professor of History, Colette Hyman. In the talk, Professor Hyman will discuss her experience teaching over the summer of 2015 at Sisseton Wahpeton College on the Lake Traverse Reservation in Sisseton, South Dakota. She will share how working in this distinctive educational environment gave her an opportunity to reflect on WSU as an educational environment and how her experience has reshaped teaching of U.S. history and scholarship on Dakota women. Professor Hyman's research interests migrated from the U.S. labor movement to the Native peoples of this region. In 2012, she published Dakota Women's Work, Creativity, Culture, and Exile, with the Minnesota Historical Society Press.
I'm Catherine Lammers. I'm just introducing the speaker. So before we get started, I just want to say thank you to the students who were in campaign design class who worked so hard to develop all the advertisement materials, Kelly Nichols, Shelby Hickman in particular, and Professor Moss. So we want to thank them, and we want to thank the LACE Committee and University Communications. They all helped bring this together. This is the class talks, which stands for Consortium of Liberal Arts and Science Promotion. So it's kind of a good little acronym. You can see we've got quite a few more coming up, so I hope you can come to some of those too. Okay, so tonight I get to welcome Colette Hyman, and she is presenting on her work with the Dakota Indians and all the different experiences. She has a book. As a whole teaching experience, I'm pretty excited to hear about this. So we'll have a question and answer, and I can use this to help you with your questions. So feel free to raise your hand, okay? So thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Thank you, CLASP Committee and LACE Committee. And thank you to everybody who's here for this opportunity to share my reflections on my experience teaching at Sisseton Wahpeton College last summer, an experience that was transformational for me in so many ways. I also want to take this opportunity to thank all of my Dakota teachers over the years, the women and men who have spent time with me sharing their family stories and their own experiences and knowledge so that I might be able to teach and write about the Dakota and other Native peoples with more understanding and truthfulness. I also want to acknowledge that we are learning here, as we are learning here at Winona State University, we are doing so in the homelands, the ancestral and historical homelands of the Dakota Nation, who themselves remain banned from the state of Minnesota by U.S. law. I want to distill all that I learned on my summer vacation into three sets of lessons. One will be about conceptualizing and teaching U.S. history. One will be about the meaning of doing research, and I have research in quotation marks, in a colonized culture and community. And one about the meanings and experiences of colonization itself, and about sovereignty and self-determination. Over the 10 years that I worked on my book, Dakota Women's Work, which came out in 2012, I spent a few days each summer, maybe up to a couple of weeks in total, in the Dakota communities of Santee, Nebraska and Flandreau, South Dakota. And over the course of those visits, I got to know many people with whom I could not have written that book. And when the book was done, I wanted to maintain those relationships and to continue my learning. While doing this work, I also got to know some of the folks of the Sisseton Wahpeton Nation, and I knew that this community was very different historically and culturally from Santee and Flandreau. For one thing, it's located on what had historically been Dakota homelands. So I thought I would continue my research on Dakota history and culture there. And I made my first visit in January of 2013. And just to give you a little bit idea of the geography, if you get on I-90 and go directly all the way west across the state, you will eventually, soon when you get into South Dakota, run into I-29. So you just take a right on the next interstate. And if you go about 30 miles north, you'll be in Flandreau. If you go another 80 miles beyond that, you'll be at the exit to Syston, South Dakota, and the reservation is right there. To get to Santee, Nebraska, you would go south on I-29 across the southern part of South Dakota and then jog over to Yankton, and then you're just about to Santee. That was my previous destination, and now when I go to do this work, I do it in Syston. And a number of you may have heard and met Gabrielle Tateyushkanshkan, who was here a couple of weeks ago. The work that I'm doing now is in her community on the reservation that she lives on and that she grew up in. And she's one of my teachers. She and her mother, Yvonne Wind, and her daughter, Vivian, are some of the key members of that community who make my work there possible. And sometime during the summer of 2014, I mentioned to them that I thought that someday I would want to teach at a tribal college, maybe on a sabbatical or maybe beyond that when I retire. And they said, well, why wait? You can teach here next summer at the tribal college. So just about a year ago today, I had a conversation with the academic VP there, and I learned my first lesson, of many that I would learn, that I could teach if I got enough students. So now I know why those who teach adjunct and fixed term are called contingent, because they're teaching contingent on getting enough students. And I only got enough students because I taught the class at two different sections, one in the middle of the day when it was scheduled and one at the end of the day, so that folks who had jobs till 4 or 4:30 could come. I don't recommend that to any of my colleagues here who are in the contingent labor force. I had a specific purpose, and being able to teach gave me a concrete reason to be in the community and paid my rent and defrayed my costs for being there. And I ended up with a very unique group of students. All but one were my age or older. Three of the seven, you know, I was really just barely making it. And actually, the college probably lost money over me because most of those students are elders. At 55 and older, you're an elder, and elders don't have to pay tuition. Anyway, three of the seven had college degrees. One of them has a master's degree in education from Harvard. And most of them were also very involved in community politics in one way or another. And all of them are from the community with long and deep roots there. So I really had a very unique group of students, and I call them my teachers rather than my students. Because in the end, I think that I probably learned a lot more from them than they did from me, but I think we all had a pretty good time along the way, and they deeply inspired me to teach in a way that would be valuable to them, and valuable, I believe, to the students I work with here. Which brings me to my first lesson, which is about teaching the U.S. History Survey 1865 to the present on sovereign land and teaching here in Dakota homelands. The question I was facing was how I was going to make this history interesting and relevant and meaningful to Native students, especially adults who knew far more about their own history than I ever will. And I realized that however much more I have been discussing Native issues in my classes over the past few years, Native peoples remain marginal to how I understand and teach about U.S. history. In fact, I had committed the error that historians had committed when first trying to integrate women into the study of history, which was what some have called add women and stir, of course, not as a positive thing, that, oh yeah, that was just add women and stir, which doesn't really work. And it doesn't really work for Native people. I had been adding Indians and stirring. And so while I wasn't talking about westward expansion, but instead conquest of Native lands and colonization, and while I make sure to talk about the Indian Reorganization Act, for instance, during the New Deal and the American Indian Movement when we get to the 1960s, I still had no consistent narrative for integrating, for talking about indigenous peoples in my U.S. survey, which of course makes me realize why when we get to the end of the semester, and here I think that I'm doing students a favor by having a novel, of course that novel is set on a reservation, it's the Roundhouse, students still seem at a loss and had no way of connecting the issues raised in the novel with what we've been doing, even though I thought I'd been doing a reasonable job. But I realize now it's because I did not have that integrated focus on Native people throughout my class, which I'm working toward, especially as I was facing a class of very well-informed, educated Native people. So I really had to work pretty fast. And I won't say that I have a complete narrative, but I think I've made some progress, and I want to highlight three different moments in this historical period since the Civil War in which I think there is room, particular room, for developing an ongoing indigenous narrative within the history of the United States. Now, of course, working with Dakota students in a Dakota tribal community, I would start with the Dakota War of 1862, integrated into a discussion of the Civil War. But I also had to talk about the causes and outcomes of the Civil War. And of course, I would have to talk about slavery, and I would have to do that all in a way that was relevant to Native issues. I really wanted to have this be an education about U.S. history that wasn't just some detached narrative that once in a while brought in Indian people, people like the people in my class, but that really made their history, their issues, their concerns central to the narrative that I was teaching. So the way in which I tried to do this in the early lessons was to think about how slavery, in fact, is an issue of land. And talking about how nearly the whole early national period is one of conflicts over how to integrate new territories into the United States, and which would be slave states and which would be free states, in order to maintain that critical balance in Congress between slave states and free states to put off any kind of the final rupture that would happen in the, after 1860. But of course, all of these lands, whether they were coming in as slave or as free, were lands that U.S. settlers and soldiers and civilian officials and missionaries had taken from their indigenous populations. So slavery in this context was in a very deep way made possible by the conquest of Native lands. The Civil War then becomes a conflict over the means of controlling and exploiting resources taken from Native people. And the Dakota War becomes part of a larger story of conflict over the nature of colonization and the expropriation of land, but also of labor. So that was my first section of integrating the history of Native people with the bigger outlines, the conventional outlines of U.S. history. World War I is another area that I think worked pretty well in terms of integrating Native issues. I had for a while already been teaching about World War I as a war that was centrally about empire. It was a war between empires, and it was war over empires, focusing on World War I as an outcome of European territorial expansion into Africa and Asia, but also over conquest of contiguous lands within European nations conquered by other European nations. And in all these cases, imperial powers imposing their languages, their educational system, governing structures, and often religions on subject people, whether they were neighbors across the river in Pesht, or whether they were Ethiopians or Libyans on the African continent. So all of this, of course, when we start thinking about empire and colonization and efforts to assimilate conquered nations into the dominant culture would run very much parallel to the narrative of the dispossession of Native peoples in the United States and the Americas more broadly, and makes U.S. involvement in World War I more than about revenge, for instance, for the sinking of the Titanic, or appreciation for General Lafayette's help during the American Revolution. I should say that I used a primary document that was also really evocative for the students, and it was an article written by W.E.B. Du Bois about the roots of American colonialism. And he really very directly ties World War I to the colonization of Africa and to the expropriation of those lands. And that analysis resonated very, very deeply with my teachers in the classroom at Sisseton Wahpeton College. I'll just give you another example of, and this I haven't quite figured out, but of how to integrate a dominant narrative with a narrative of Native history, and that's in the following decade after World War I, which is the decade of the 1920s, in which we see a culmination of a number of anti-immigrant movements converging and finding success. So you have the ratification of the amendment to the Constitution that would prohibit the manufacture and sale of alcohol, which had been very much targeted at immigrant groups. You have the first overarching laws limiting immigration, and then you have the growing movement of eugenics. This is also the period in which citizenship was forced on Native peoples in the U.S. Without consulting them, the U.S. Congress decided that, was it 1924, all Native Americans now would be fully U.S. citizens. Until then, some were, some weren't. It's complicated. But after 1924, they would all be citizens with full voting rights where they would be accessible, of course, without consulting Native people. So you have this new definition of who gets to be a citizen and who gets to count as American in that way. This conjunction of these movements allowed me to talk about how notions of race and of citizenship change over time, and of how citizenship, in fact, becomes a tool used by elites to control and also integrate various diverse populations into a hegemonic state. Now, of course, citizenship did not necessarily come with voting rights, and we need to consider how the franchise has always been a contingent right in the United States, and as we know, continues to be so. So I haven't really worked out that piece of it, but I think I would like to think more about how a decade that saw prohibition and eugenics and immigration restriction and a resurgence of the Klan also saw this effort to integrate Native people into the U.S. polity. Overall, my task in this class was and remains how to teach and think about U.S. history with Native peoples at the center. And if we start with the experience of Native peoples, then we have to think, what are the main outlines of U.S. history? Now, I have to say that this is not an entirely new project for me. It's the question that feminist historians have been asking since I was in college, and the one that led me to become a historian. I was really said a number of times in my classes that really what compelled me about history was that first women's history class, where I really felt that I was being asked to think about everything I had learned about U.S. history in a totally new way. I thought that was totally cool, and I hope that some of you agree. So how to teach U.S. history with Native peoples at the center is revisiting a cognitive and intellectual process that was at the very origin of my career as a historian. And I have to say that at this time in my career, posing that question is giving me a new energy and excitement about teaching this U.S. survey and other courses that I've been teaching for a long time. But these are also the kinds of questions, how to put Native people at the center, that I have to ask myself as a scholar of Native history. And it's a question that has come into sharper focus over the summer in my experience this summer. And that leads me to my second lesson, which is about doing research in a colonized community. It occurred to me when I was thinking about this that the work that I do, conducting oral histories, which is one of the main sources, not one of the main, it's a central source to doing my work, is a methodology that I've been doing ever since I was a little puppy historian. My dissertation research, which then grew into the research for my first book, used very heavily oral history interviews. And this was about the labor movement in the 1930s. And I got to know a lot of men and women who spent time in the 1930s organizing in New York City, in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, and St. Paul. And they were sharing with me some of their experiences, some of their insights, and how this all looked to them many decades later. And some of them I stayed in touch with for quite a while. One woman I was in touch with for probably 20 years. and even got to reconnect with her. And my interview with her actually was on the phone because she was already, had moved to California. We had a number of conversations over the phone. And then when I was living in Arizona, she was visiting and we met for the first time and it was wonderful. But as wonderful as that was, these were really valuable relationships. But when I started doing interviews for Dakota Women's Work, I felt a very different sense of obligation vis-a-vis the people that I was interviewing. I felt that I owed them much more. I had learned already that I needed to bring gifts, which I'm embarrassed to say never occurred to me when I was doing interviews for my dissertation. Nobody told me I should, and I guess I was expected that I would know, and I didn't, and it didn't seem to have stood in the way. It didn't seem to be part of the necessary introductions and exchanges. I also never felt obligated to share with the men and women I had interviewed the tapes themselves or transcripts, much less the book, when the book came out. I had left open the possibility that I would deposit the research tapes in an archive somewhere. That was on my informed consent, my consent form. But those cassettes are still in my attic with totally outdated technology that nobody could probably use anyway. So I really didn't feel that beyond whether I might exchange notes, holidays, or whatever over a few years, that I had that any kind of obligation. Very, very different when I started the work that led first to Dakota Women's Work, and that's continuing now. I always bring gifts to interviews. I learned that I could not take for granted the participation of the men and women I was inviting to participate in these interviews. And I wanted to be sure also not to reproduce this long history of imperialist scholarship that had been based on white scholars going into Native communities, collecting evidence, leaving to make their careers based on that evidence, and not returning until it was time for a new project. I was very aware of that history and of not wanting to perpetuate that history. I knew I didn't want to be that white scholar coming into a Native community. But I was still not prepared for what I encountered when I went to Sistan, to the community that Gabrielle is from. That community has a tribal historic preservation office and a research office, each of which has procedures and regulations governing research on the reservation. The Tribal Historic Preservation Office is part of the NAGPRA legislation, Native American Graves Repatriation Act, that provides or that encourages tribal communities to take control over their cultural resources and make sure that in the process of construction or other forms of land use, that there wouldn't be culturally sensitive areas that would be disturbed. The research office was set up, had been set up just a few months earlier to manage a very large health research project with the Sanford Medical Conglomerate that was in partnership with the tribe, and I think it was on diabetes. Neither of these offices had dealt with a request to gather oral histories from elders, and neither was particularly open to that possibility. But at the same time, though, I had by then a member of the community, a woman named Florestine Kiyukompi Renville, herself a journalist and a writer, who had agreed to work with me fully as a partner. And I also had a number of other community members who really objected to being told by tribal officials who they could and couldn't talk to, because if I had followed those protocols, there would have been all sorts of permissions, and the tribe would have regulated who I was talking to, and by implication, who tribal members could talk to. And the tribe also would have required that they get all the rights to the interviews and that they could keep those interviews. And on the one hand, that would get in the way of the project that I had planned and the project that I was going to be doing with Floristine and with the support of some community members about their community. So I had to really think about where I was and what my self-interest was and what I wanted to accomplish, and also how much does tribal government represent tribal members, and which is a whole huge thorny issue that I would only hint at now, but I'd be happy to talk more. I, of course, learn a ton more about it in conversation with the folks in my class. And I want to make clear that I did have an IRB from Winona State. I had gone through all of the required procedures to ensure that my research plan was going to protect the interests of the people I was interviewing, as well as Winona State and myself. So all of this made me really think about, do some serious soul searching about what I wanted to accomplish with these interviews. And I had to balance wanting to respect these tribal rules with also wanting to work with tribal members for whom those rules were a real obstacle and which they felt did not represent them or their culture. And they also saw that what we wanted to do was to preserve parts of that culture, conduct interviews with elders that would be available to the community, that could be a resource for the community seeking to maintain its history. Because I had also committed, as I did in my first project with the Dakota, to sharing my research materials. And with that project, I did make transcripts, I did make copies of the audio recordings that I gave to the folks that I interviewed. I gave people I interviewed a copy of my book, and I certainly had the intention of doing that, have the intention of doing that if there is a book at the end of this process. Even with my motives being clear to me and my sense of wanting to do what's right and not just take this knowledge but have it be an exchange, that's me, right? It's not the members of that community. The solution that we came up with and that I proposed to the Sisseton Wahpeton College, which is the tribal college where I was teaching, was that I would gather these oral histories with Floristine, and then we would deposit transcripts and the copies of the tapes themselves in the college library where they would be available to anybody, including us, but also members of the community. And my model there is what the Minnesota Historical Society does, and you can go to their website, and they have all of these oral history interviews that are posted there. You could get the audio, you could get the transcript, and it makes it universally accessible, and that was my vision, and hopefully that's what's going to come out of this project, so that this will no longer be exclusively my research project or a research project that I'm doing with Floristine, but rather a process for preserving the knowledge and experience of the elders in a community that has been so long cut off from its history, and that there'll be different uses made, and there might be some scholarship by an outside scholar like myself, or Floristine might use it on her own, and members of the community might use it in different ways for their own teaching. It'll be in the community, inside an institution of that community. And I want to be clear that without the support of members of that community and without the commitment of a member of the community to work with me on this, I would never have proceeded. But it's still a balancing act, and I constantly have to ask myself what's in it for me and how might my work reinscribe colonizing process and how can my work, on the contrary, challenge some of those colonizing processes. And as I said, this was always my purpose, starting with Dakota Women's work, as well as with this project, to make my work useful to the communities about which I write. And again, this was never entered my mind when I was doing that research project with old lefties from the 1930s. Now, in terms of what's in it for me, I'm certainly not going to get rich off of any royalties. And as a full professor going into the project, I don't have any professional material rewards, but I know that I'm reaping some benefits. I get to talk to all of you here, not just in my classroom, but then you come talk to me, listen to me here. So I get these benefits, and I'm hoping that what are the benefits accruing to folks here and folks in the communities I'm writing about from gaining the knowledge from my work. And I don't know, right? But it's like teaching. You never really know the impact of your work. But like teaching, right, we continue to do it because deep down we're convinced that we're making some kind of positive impact. And still, these questions stay with me, and they've become again sharper after my summer teaching at Sisseton Wahpeton College because of how much more clearly I now understand these issues of colonization and sovereignty that are so tied in to all of the complexities of myself as a white person doing research in a tribal community. And that leads me to my third set of lessons, which is about being in a tribal community, living in a colonized community, and getting to look from inside a little bit at how that community works. And I'm not going to indulge here in the kind of poverty porn that you get in the mainstream media, where the only thing that you read about reservations is about the abuse of one form or another, and the poverty and suicide. All of those things are true, and I have to wonder why that's the only thing that the mainstream media reports on regarding Native communities. And that's not what I'm going to focus on. I want to talk about the beautiful buildings at the center of the community, this beautiful K-12 school built a little bit on a rise that is built in the shape of an eagle, Teospazina School, which was built in the last 10 years. I want to talk about the beautiful new tribal building, which was built in the last couple of years in the shape of a teepee. And so it's circular, and there the hallways are arranged outside the external walls, and the offices are arranged around there. And then inside, in the center, is this wonderful rotunda where many community events take place. And it's beautiful in concept. The acoustics are terrible, and I'm sure that it's just hugely inefficient to heat. But it's beautiful, and it really represents all the possibilities of self-determination and even sovereignty. And then, of course, the building that I most want to talk about is the one where I spent the most time this summer, which is the building of Sisseton Wahpeton College. All of these buildings and all of these accomplishments, new housing, for instance, a new health clinic that was open in the last 5 years, all reflect a turn in U.S. Indian policy toward this notion of self-determination. Self-determination was a term first used by Native groups like the National Congress of American Indians to talk about their goals and wanting to reclaim the power to govern themselves. And the federal government, under influence from these groups and under pressure from National Congress of American Indian, the Native American Youth Council, American Indian Movement, began to rethink its policy of termination that it had inaugurated in the 1950s, whereby tribes would just be disbanded, poof, and there would be no more need to provide services or, conversely, to fulfill treaty responsibilities. And that was just a terrible policy, and it ended up not ending the existence of Native people, just as allotment, boarding school, citizenship had not done away with Native peoples or Native cultures. And so this new direction in federal policy came to be first articulated in a speech in 1968 by Lyndon Johnson, but then promoted by none other than Richard Nixon. And I have to say that one of the most enjoyable unintended consequences of this work is to find redeeming qualities to Richard Nixon, who, according to Samuel Cook, who is an anthropologist and the head of American Indian Studies at Virginia Tech University, quote, "Nixon exhibited a far greater concern for Indian affairs than any president in the 20th century." And it was a very rich period in Native history in terms of U.S. policy. You have the legislation that there's self-determination, and I'm sorry I don't have the name, that was passed in 1974 that, among other things, created a system for establishing tribal colleges. Some of you might be familiar with the Indian Child Welfare Act that was passed in 1978 after Nixon, but following on this notion of Indian self-determination. And then in 1988, Congress passed the Indian Gaming Rights Act again, giving Native people more control over their communities and allowing them to establish compacts with states that would provide for casinos, all of which opened the way for this New Buffalo, the casinos, which provides some income to some tribal communities, and some of those buildings that I was talking about, some of the funding comes from those casinos. With this new latitude to regulate its own affairs, and with this new revenue stream from casinos, the Assiniboine Wahpeton tribe undertook a number of projects, including the building of, this much-needed health center I mentioned, housing, district community centers, a couple of schools, including Teoshpazina that I mentioned. And in the last couple of years, this beautiful tribal office building. And the college itself, which was first established in 1979 and got a new auditorium a couple of years ago. They're talking about building dorms now that would be family housing. And there is a new technical arts building as well. And I want to really look at what all of this means in terms of these notions, what self-determination means, colonization, sovereignty. Is all of this about sovereignty? And I want to explore this a little bit. And I want to say that without minimizing the advancements that these institutions and this new autonomy, partial autonomy, represent in terms of standard of living and education, none of these developments, in fact, should be confused with sovereignty. If we consider a nation sovereign when it can govern itself, sustain itself materially and spiritually, and educate its young according to its own values in its own language in ways that are congruent with teachings and traditions of that nation, then the Assiniboine Wahpeton Nation, like even the most economically successful tribal communities, is still far from sovereign. And I'll just explain that to you by talking a little bit about the college I taught at. It's a two-year college that offers associate's degrees in areas like business, carpentry, technology, addiction counseling, early childhood development, and sustainable environmental studies. It also offers an associate of arts in general studies and in Dakota studies and various certificates. And this is very comparable to the curriculum in other tribal colleges, except that you wouldn't have necessarily Dakota studies at a Blackfeet Reservation College. You'd have Blackfeet College and Blackfeet culture. And these curricula really are oriented toward serving the needs of the communities. And they are accredited by the Higher Learning Commission so that they, too, get to do assessment and review and all of those happy things and have HLC accreditors come visit them every 10 years, and that means that students who take classes there and graduate are able to then transfer into four-year institutions, and many of them are encouraged to do so. I want to make a little pitch here for Minsku, which is unique in having a two-year tribal college as part of the system. Fond du Lac Tribal College is part of the Minsku system, and it's working now with Winona State on a 2+2 arrangement for education programs. So that's pretty cool to have in our system a tribal college. And I think also Fond du Lac is probably the only tribal college that's part of a larger state higher education system. In addition to this, everyone teaching at Assiniboine Wahpeton College has to indicate how their course will advance students in four core abilities, one of which is integrating Dakota culture and values into personal and professional activities. And I had to talk about that on my syllabus. And then the college logo includes four symbols associated with Dakota values. You have a bear paw that stands for Wowaditake, brave or bravery. You have an eagle, which stands for Woksapi, which is wisdom. the buffalo, which stands for Wakiksapi, which is endurance. And then you have, of course, a book and a mortar board, which stands for Wostonye, which is knowledge. So you have an effort, despite being part of HLC, to have a distinctive Dakota component to the institution. On the other hand, of the 15 full-time faculty, only three are Native. The president, Harvey DeMars, is a member of the community, as are most of the staff, most of whom have associate's degree from the college. But the academic VP is a European-American woman, as were the last two CFOs. And that means that the hardest and most consequential decisions made at the college are made by individuals who are not part of the community that the college serves. Most of the non-Native staff and faculty live in Watertown and other white towns around the reservation. Very few of the faculty and staff who are not Native or married to tribal members live on the reservation or in Siston, which is the mostly white town in the middle of the reservation. For the most part, these demographics of faculty and staff are themselves artifacts of colonization. There are not enough qualified Native people to run the school. And I would say that even some of the white faculty and staff are themselves insufficiently qualified. Of the non-teaching staff, only three have four-year degrees, and that includes the academic counselor, whose associate's degree is from Siston Wahpeton College, the student services director, who has a master's degree, actually, and is working on a doctorate and is European-American, and the director of technology, a man named Scott Morgan, who has a bachelor's degree of science, that's all I know about it, from NDSU. Scott Morgan is officially the director of technology at the college, which includes long-distance learning, right? He also teaches the one history class that is taught by a permanent staff of the college, and it's Western Civ. Okay. So I take particular exceptions. This particularly sticks in my craw. He does a great job with technology, and he was very helpful to me. But I have to wonder what qualifies him to teach European history, and I further have to wonder what resources and expertise he can draw on to teach Western Civ in a way that addresses issues of concern or relevance to his Native students. Even if this Bachelor of Science degree is the kind of Bachelor of Science in teaching that our history department provides, right, through the social science history teaching major, I don't know how many of the students graduating from that program would be able to indigenize a Western Civ class or even a U.S. history class, despite my best efforts. And I have to wonder what resources and expertise Mr. Morgan has to address these concerns. And is he even aware that it's possible to indigenize a course based on the premise of Western civilization? But I can't fault him for any of this because it's not his job. I'm sure that when he was hired to be the director of technology, it wasn't part of the job description that he would teach Western Civ. But I would suggest that this situation, the technology director, a white man with a bachelor's degree teaching Western civilization, reinscribes colonization in at least three different ways. First of all, the unquestioned adoption of Western civilization shows the extent, this notion of Western civilization, I think it was Gandhi who said, yeah, that would be a good idea, shows the extent to which dominant culture concepts shape this curriculum at a tribal college. The teaching of this course by someone with no evident qualification reminds us of the lack of resources, human and otherwise, in tribal communities that have suffered from the inability to develop their own sustainable economies and sustainable education system. And I should say, with regard to education, of course, that so much of this is a legacy of the boarding school system that not only cut off Native people from their cultures, but cut them off from any kind of meaningful education that would allow them to achieve professions, achieve careers in the professions or in business that would allow them to come back to their communities and serve them thoroughly and effectively in leadership positions. Third, I think that the teaching of this course by a white person also reflects the legacy of boarding schools and the systematic exclusion of Native people from quality educational experiences. And then, of course, there's another way in which this situation shows colonized thinking, of course, which is the devaluation of the teaching of history, right? Because if it was valued, I'm sure they might manage to find somebody with appropriate credentials. But that might just be my bias as a historian. The question is still, can there be real, meaningful sovereignty when an education is mostly exogenous to the culture and when that education is delivered by women and men from outside that culture, i.e. from dominant culture? And this is perhaps self-determination, but Sistine Wahpeton College is still an institution operating within colonialist systems and structures. And this reality, like the reality of unimaginable need in all areas of health and social services, creates, in fact, many opportunities for white people to step in on reservations all over the country. Indeed, many of us in education, social work, health, mental health fields are proud to talk about our experience working on Indian reservations. And I would guess that for many such adults who have grown up in church communities, working on a reservation is something that they might have learned about on a youth mission trip. Or maybe they learned about doing such work from a travel study program to an impoverished place in the Caribbean or India or Africa. Because, of course, all of us are providing much needed services, but aren't we as well reinscribing colonization when we're doing that? And how might these services performed by well-intentioned white students and adults enacting a role of white savior not reinforce the idea of such places as needing the help, quote-unquote, of white people who can then come away feeling good about having helped poor brown-skinned people living in wretched conditions? And then they come home with photos of themselves surrounded by wide-eyed, smiling, brown-eyed children, brown-skinned children, hugging them. How are these students not enacting the imperialist vision of taking up the white man's burden? Could such experience, conversely, be constructed to challenge colonization? What are we teaching our students when we take them to Pine Ridge or St. Croix or India or Kenya about why there is so much need for their work in orphanages, in schools, or on various infrastructure projects? Are they learning? Are you learning about why such need exists? Are you learning about the history of colonization and dispossession and exploitation that has caused the poverty and disease and quote-unquote, underdevelopment? Turning back to my own work, how can I, in my own teaching and research, engage in anti-colonial decolonizing work? Can indigenizing the curriculum and individual classes, both when I'm teaching here and when I'm teaching at Sistine Wahpeton College, or can working in partnership with tribal members on oral history research projects, or sharing this analysis with all of you, contribute in any way to challenging systems and structures of colonization? I don't know for sure. But I do know that not doing these things, at the very least, does nothing to undo colonization and problematize colonialism. So just as I go back to the classroom every week and every year, except when I get a sabbatical, with the goal of challenging students to find your curiosity and expand your thinking, I'll continue to do this work, asking hard questions along the way, with the goal of pushing back at the structures and powers of colonialism and empowering students and readers to take on some of that work as well. And I invite you all to join me. Thank you.
Thanks again to Professor Colette Hyman for her presentation, How Teaching at a Tribal College Changed My Life, or at least my teaching. Professor Hyman teaches in the History Department at Winona State University. Her talk was a presentation of the CLASP series. CLASP is the Consortium of Liberal Arts and Science Promotion. The CLASP lecture series was initiated in 2004 and is intended to promote interdisciplinary discussion and exchange. More information on the CLASP series can be found at www.winona.edu/lectures/clasp.asp. Tune in next week as we bring you the question and answer portion of Professor Hyman's presentation and a one-on-one interview about her experience teaching at the Sisseton-Wahpeton Tribal College over the summer of 2015. I'm Terry Tensett, and you've been listening to Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click. Mm-hmm.